Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. They were called petticoat pilots, ladybirds, or most commonly, fly girls. And in the 1920s and 30s, they broke barriers for women in aviation and American society at large. Now a new book tells the story of these female pilots who fought for equal treatment in the skies. It's called Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. The author is Keith O'Brien, a former Boston Globe reporter and writer for many national publications. He joins us in studio, and he'll be at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord tonight. You can get more information about that event on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And let's bring you into our conversation right now. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or just give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Keith O'Brien, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
Well, the story starts in the decade known as the Roaring Twenties, and you know, a lot of people associate that, Keith, with a hot economy. What were the societal trends, Keith, that were also roaring at that time?
So my narrative begins really in 1927, so late 1920s. We're about 7 years removed from women winning the right to vote in this country. And that has changed a great deal, not just at the polls, at the ballot box, but in homes. The right to exercise a vote has changed women in a lot of ways. They are now wanting to wear different kinds of clothes, wear pants, wear their hair shorter. Divorce is on the rise. And most notably in 1927, the Episcopal Book of Prayer no longer makes it a requirement for a woman to say she will obey her husband during her marriage vows. This too is controversial and cause for a lot of debate. So a lot of cultural changes are happening at that time.
A lot of opening up of gender roles, as you said, although at the same time, I think there was a New York Times editorial said that being a woman was almost like having a disability because there's so many things that you're still not allowed to do.
Well, that's true. And the New York Times did say that. And what they were getting at is in the late 1920s, there were laws, actual laws that forbade women from doing all sorts of things, from serving on juries, from filing lawsuits, from working the night shift, from driving taxi cabs. Women were banned in the late 1920s from as many as 15 different professions. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, just from a functional, operational standpoint, our laws were making women second-class citizens. And so the few women who dared to fly, who dared to race airplanes, were true radicals.
Yeah, not just flying, you know, going from A to B, but racing. I'm going to talk about those air shows in a minute, Keith, because they're pretty amazing. But in terms of aviation at that time, so let's just set the time period out there. You write that in the 1920s, there were, quote, countless ways to die in an airplane. By the way, I want to let you know that I read that line while I was in an airplane and felt better that it was right now. How dangerous was it to fly?
So, you know, one of the things that shocked me the most as I delved into this research was just how many ways an airplane could fail in the late 1920s. You know, not just getting lost in the fog or getting lost in a storm, which happened all the time, but you know, engines would stop, and there was no way to explain why. Planes would crash, and investigators would come in, and the investigators would say, "We have no idea why." And you know, most shocking to me is at times the wings of these early planes would just fall off. Just, you know, fall off the plane in the middle of a flight. And, you know, the reason why primarily was that planes were built from a different material than they are today. They were the weight of a plane was the biggest obstacle to actual flight. And so planes needed to be light. So they were built with wood and essentially a linen material that was stretched over the wood and then lacquered to be firm and tight. And so, you know, when the wood rotted, you had no idea. And so you could be in the middle of a plane ride or a race and the wing just falls off.
So lightweight wood lacquered on linen. When I read that, Keith, I thought, okay, I would not want to go up in that plane. How did the growing aviation industry respond to the danger? I mean, in the book, there's crash after crash after crash. I mean, all these very skilled male and female pilots are dying flying. So how did the industry respond to this?
Well, early in the 1920s, they started to hold what were known as air rodeos. It'd be the equivalent, really, to our modern air shows. But around 1927, 1928, as air fever really takes hold in America, they changed the air rodeos into something much more grand. They're the air races now, the national air races. And this really begins in 1928 in Los Angeles. Used car salesman is hired to promote these air races. He identifies a bean and barley field just south of LA in Inglewood to be the home of the 1928 air races. This bean and barley field, by the way, is known today by three letters, LAX. So this race, these races in 1928 are really a chance to market aviation. You know, bring in Charles Lindbergh. Bring in Amelia Earhart. Bring in one of my other characters, Ruth Elder. You know, put them on display and give people a show, and not just a show like we know today with our modern air races, but a real race with winners, losers, jackpots of money for the victors, massive crowds. It is really, you know, the birth of the modern air races. And it really was about marketing aviation and showing what planes could do.
Well, and just remind us what it was like to be at one of those air shows, Keith. I mean, you describe it was hugely popular.
The closest thing I could compare them to today would really be the Super Bowl.
That's a big deal.
Well, here's why. I mean, you'd have 125,000 paying fans in the grandstands. You'd have just as many, if not more, watching for free on the hoods of their automobiles parked on nearby highways. You know, half a million people in a single weekend watching air races. And cities would vie to host the races. They would bid against each other for the right to host the air races, because if you were a city hosting the air races, it meant you were relevant, you were futuristic, you were cutting edge. Every city, every town wanted to be a part of these things.
Another thing I noticed with these air races is how much the Midwest played a role in this budding aviation industry, in this excitement over air races. You know, today people in the Midwest feel like, oh, we're flyover country and everybody pays attention to the East and West Coast. But the Midwest is really important in this story.
It is. You know, in the late 1920s, Kansas...
Your book starts in Wichita, I think.
Kansas, of all places, was really a hotbed of aviation. There were two airplane factories in Wichita that were churning out airplanes, and you know, a couple of my main characters really get their start in Wichita on the planes, you know, flying planes, airplanes in the high prairie grass just east of town there. And you know, it was a place where aviation was really born. And of course, Kansas is also the actual birthplace of Amelia Earhart as well.
All right. Well, and let's get into some of the characters in this book. You mentioned Earhart. And we'll talk about the other women as well. I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We're talking about a brand new book today in the exchange. It's called Fly Girls: How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. The author, Keith O'Brien, is with us. And we're learning more about this pretty unknown story about the role of women in the growing aviation industry about 100 years ago, in the 1920s and the 1930s. Let's get your questions and comments in. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So we should start with Amelia Earhart. Obviously, she's the one that everybody knows. But before we talk about her, Keith, what about the other four? Why are they not as well known as Ms. Earhart?
Well, it's a great question. And you know, I think a couple things are happening here. One, just on a macro level, I think as a culture, we have a tendency to be reductive, especially when it comes to women's history. You know, we've got Amelia Earhart, and so it sort of checks the box, if you will, for our female aviator. But, you know, specifically to why the others were forgotten, you also have to look at Earhart herself. You know, in the early 1930s, there was a lot of debate about who was the best female aviator in this country. And indeed, you could make the case that it was not Amelia Earhart, and she knew that as well. But by 1937, when Earhart goes missing, she has made, at that point, a number of bold, daring, and historic flights. She is clearly the most famous of them all. And then, of course, she disappears. So now you have her fame and her mystery, and the fact that her husband, George Putnam of Putnam Publishing, would do everything he could in the last couple decades of his life, making sure that people remembered Earhart. So I think Earhart's fame and the mystery and the efforts of her husband, George Putnam, to keep her in the news both when she was alive and dead really sucked a lot of the oxygen out of the room and really did make her most known and essentially erased the others.
Well, and later in her career, as you alluded to, Keith, she did do some pretty incredible things. But earlier on, some of these other women did achieve more than she did. Let's talk about one of them, if we could. Ruth Nichols. She's not known. Until I read this book, I'd never heard her name. How is she big in aviation?
Ruth Nichols was the daughter of Wall Street wealth. She was born on the Upper East Side of New York and raised in Westchester County. The first bold and rebellious decision that Ruth Nichols made was that she was not going to get married and get married young like her parents wanted her to do. She was going to go to college, and she would come here to New England and attend Wellesley College just outside of Boston, graduating from Wellesley in 1924. It is when she is at Wellesley that Ruth Nichols decides she's going to follow a different path. She's going to be an aviator. She's going to fly. She learns to fly. She gets a license. And by 1928, most Americans do not know the name Amelia Earhart. But Ruth Nichols is well known on the East Coast. Stories of her flights have filled the New York newspapers. And, you know, she is particularly upset, Ruth Nichols is, when Amelia Earhart is chosen, essentially plucked from obscurity working as a social worker in Boston, to be the first woman to be flown across the ocean by men.
And this is like a piece of cargo, by the way, Earhart said.
Well, yeah, that's what she said, you know, and we've forgotten this. You know, we've reduced the story of Amelia Earhart to this one image of her flying solo across the ocean. But the truth is, it doesn't start there. You know, it starts with her working as a social worker, chosen by wealthy men, including George Putnam, to be a passenger aboard a plane flown by men across the ocean. When that plane makes it across, Earhart becomes famous in 1928. And that's the first sort of blow to Ruth Nichols, because she already was a proven aviator on the East Coast. And she does wonder, why wasn't I picked? Why wasn't I chosen? Why wasn't I called? And she'll spend the next couple of years working hard, Ruth Nichols will, to eclipse Amelia Earhart. And by 1931, just objectively speaking, Ruth Nichols is the most accomplished female aviator in this country. She's got the record for speed. She's got the record for altitude. And she is going to be the first woman to try to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean, leaving from Brooklyn, New York in June of 1931. And, you know, were it not for happenstance, a little bit of bad luck, and a little bit of poor planning, Ruth Nichols may have gotten there first.
She would be the one that we talk about instead of Amelia Earhart.
Imagine how different history would be.
Well, let's play a little newsreel from Ruth Nichols. As you said, she was setting records all over the place, very well known on the East Coast. Here's a newsreel from 1931, as you mentioned, Keith, Ruth Nichols setting the women's world altitude record. Let's hear.
At Jersey City Airport, March 7, 1931, Miss Ruth Nichols prepares for try at new world's altitude flight for women. And then she's off for higher skies than any woman before her has ever seen. In plane owned by radio magnate Powell Crosley Jr. of Cincinnati, Miss Nichols is aloft for 1.5 hours, then brings the big scarlet and cream-colored Lockheed Vega in for perfect landing at Jersey Field. Fighting fatigue and thinning air, Miss Nichols' daring flight is huge success.
Well, it's great to hear those newsreels. And you can also hear, as you said, Keith, the promotional aspect. Flying a plane built by so-and-so, so-and-so of Cincinnati, describing the color. So it was a chance for these women to make a mark, but also a chance for the aviation industry to say, this is really cool, you should have one of these too.
Well, the radio audio we just heard mentions Powell Crosley. You know, he gives Ruth Nichols his Lockheed to use in this record setting venture, and you know this is how a lot of female aviators were able to get planes at this time. You know, they couldn't afford one on their own. Most men couldn't either. A plane could cost $35,000 at that time. That's over $250,000 in today's money. So Ruth Nichols, you know, begs to borrow the plane from Powell Crosley and uses it to set this record, and then will use it to try to fly across the ocean.
Well, there's another piece of sound that I want to play, another newsreel of Ruth Nichols, because, again, she's setting records right and left, it seems, as you said, Keith. And the reason I want to play this is the announcer makes a reference to Lindy, meaning Charles Lindbergh. And in so much of the coverage of these women's achievements, there's these comparisons made to Lindy. You hear it again and again. So let's hear a little bit again. This is Ruth Nichols at the end of 1930 setting a record-breaking flight from California to New York.
Here's end of record-breaking flight from Los Angeles to New York. It's 10th of December, 1930, as plane taxis to a slow stop at Roosevelt Field. And who steps out of plane but one of America's leading woman flyers, Ruth Nichols of Cincinnati. Mom's plenty proud of her daughter, too, for Ruth's flight established coast-to-coast record of 13 hours, 22 minutes, which was one full hour better than mark set by Lindy.
Okay, so there you have it. One full hour than mark set by Lindy. How did these women constantly get compared to Charles Lindbergh?
Well, you know, it starts in 1928, you know, when Amelia Earhart tries to fly across the ocean flown by men. The first nickname they give her is she's Lady Lindy.
That comes up a lot. Yeah.
Right from the beginning. You know, and well, I think the thing we have to remember is Charles Lindbergh in 1927, when he makes it across the ocean, is the most famous man in America. And he has done what was previously unthinkable. You know, we now make flights to Europe as if it's just an everyday thing. In 1927, when Lindbergh made it, there was real question about whether it was even possible. The only thing I could compare to is the question about going to the moon in the 1960s. Was it even possible? And It was so in doubt in 1927 that you'd ever be able to fly a plane nonstop from New York to Paris that engineers were working up plans to build a dock in the middle of the ocean where you could land and refuel. I mean, that's how unlikely it was.
Well, the logistics are really interesting, and the way people would go to certain spots on the East Coast to, you know, make the trajectory a little bit shorter, a little bit easier. We'll talk about that after a short break and start taking your calls too. So join us 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. The book we're talking about today, Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. We'll be right back. You can help NHPR shorten the fall fund drive. Hi, I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. For every 100 listeners who become sustaining members, we'll knock off a full day of on-air fundraising this fall. It's that simple. So if you've been waiting for the perfect time to support the programs you love, like The Exchange, Fresh Air, and All Things Considered, this is it. Become an NHPR sustaining member today for as little as $5 or $10 a month. It's quick and easy to do at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're sitting down with the author of a new book called Fly Girls, How Five Daring Women Defied All Odds and Made Aviation History. The author, Keith O'Brien, is with us. And let's get your questions in, too. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, you can email exchange@nhpr.org. Keith, before we talk about some of the other women profiled in this book and really get into Amelia Earhart's story, because it's pretty amazing, let's talk more about Charles Lindbergh. His shadow falls over all these women. No matter what they do, it's, you know, well, Lindy did this and Lindy did that. How did they feel about constantly being called, you know, Lady Lindy, you have a Lindbergh complex? How did they feel about that comparison?
Well, they knew they were going to be compared to Charles Lindbergh. It was impossible not to be compared to Charles Lindbergh. But they didn't like the names. The Lady Lindy comment, which was first applied to Amelia Earhart in 1928, was put on her by the press specifically because they thought that she looked just like Lindbergh. I don't think she does. She didn't think she did. And you know, she said that at the time. She couldn't understand why they were calling her Lady Lindy instead of Amelia Earhart. As to the other names, you know, Sweethearts of the Air and Ladybirds and Girl Flyers. The women, often said, would it, and I'm paraphrasing here, would it kill the press just to call us pilots? Because that's what they were. But with Lindbergh in mind, we have to remember just how big a character he was in 1927. When he makes it across the ocean in May of that year, he does so not just for the pioneering spirit of it all. He does it for a jackpot of money. $25,000 has been put up for the first aviator who can fly nonstop from New York to Paris or Paris to New York. Many men have died in the pursuit of that prize. Many others have gone missing over the ocean. Lindbergh makes it, but even his takeoff in New York in May of 1927 is harrowing and almost absurd. It's raining that day. It's rained all night. The runway is made of clay, not concrete. The Spirit of St. Louis passes the point on the runway where you're told if you're not in the air by this point, you should stop. He won't stop. He barely gets off before the crowd that's waiting at the end. He's so low to the ground that the crowd that's waiting there in the damp morning mist can see his face through the cockpit glass.
Wow, that's pretty close.
They can see him, and they say that he looks as if he's suddenly aged with worry. He barely gets off the ground. And so, of course he makes it. He gets across the ocean in this tiny little single-engine plane. And when he does, he becomes a massive star. He comes home famous. He comes home rich. He's given an additional $50,000 to do a goodwill tour across America, flying the Spirit of St. Louis to 90 cities that summer, just flying in, doing a parade and a dinner dance and flying out the next day. And because of this goodwill tour, because of the air fever that Lindbergh inspires, a surprising thing happens. At least it was surprising to aviation officials at the time. Women now, young women across this country begin to say, I want to be the first woman to fly across the ocean. And the difference is they're going to do it for free.
For free because nobody was willing to put up the money for them to do it?
Well, yeah, no one was going to put up the money. But, they knew now, that they didn't need a $25,000 prize to make it. If they were to make it across first, they would become famous, just as famous as Lindbergh, or so they hoped.
You mentioned the press, and, would it kill the press to just call us pilots? The media was pretty harsh on these women and their desire to fly. There's some pretty nasty quotes in there.
That was one thing that stunned me, especially as a journalist myself, just how ingrained the sexism was in the press in the 1920s and 30s. At every turn, reporters at major prestigious newspapers, you know, our leading newspapers still today, would go out of their way to take shots at the women they were writing about. You know, they never got the benefit of the doubt. They were always questioned. They were always doubted. And when they failed, as inevitably they would, as the men did too, when they crashed, when they had problems, it was never due to the plane. It was never due to the weather. It was always the fault of the woman who was flying it. It was extremely unfair. And as someone who's lived inside this story now for 2.5 years, and really gotten to know these women, I just have so much respect for them. They were willing to risk everything to do the thing they loved, sacrificing so much on the ground to do it. And for those sacrifices, they sometimes didn't even get the most basic, decent human respect. And then, when it was all over, they couldn't get jobs in the aviation industry. The new nascent airlines wouldn't hire them. They struggled. A lot of them did. And then we forgot them.
Except for Amelia Earhart, as you said.
Right.
Yeah. So, and reading about these comments, and again, they're harsh. I wonder, did they sometimes get under the women's skin in terms of not just, gee, I'm bothered by that, but, you know, a pilot needs to be confident, especially a pilot who's doing something daring that has never been done before. Did all that huge, you know, media derision, did it affect their confidence when they got into the cockpit?
Absolutely not. These women were extremely confident in their ability. They knew who they were. They knew what they could do. There was nothing that some reporter could write or say that would make them question themselves. No, not at all.
You know, talking about the names, we got an email from Sam in Dover who says, if the female pilots found the nicknames offensive, why call your book Fly Girls seems like the final offense. I think you've probably gotten that question before. Thank you, Sam, for the email.
So, you know, I explain it very early in the book. You know, Fly Girl had double meaning at the time. To be a Fly Girl was to be a woman who was bold and dangerous and didn't live by the old rules. Newspaper columnists at the time would say, you know, it's best to keep your hands off the Fly Girl. And they weren't referring to an aviator. They were referring to these young women who were refusing to abide by the rules that their mothers lived by. They were finding their own path in the world. And so, you know, and there's a certain bravado to that name. You know, Charles Lindbergh and other great male flyers of the day were called flyboys. And that was cool. And that was tough. And that was awesome. And so that's what these women were.
So Fly Girl is one of those 1920s terms that you sometimes hear that referred to those 1920s women who were playing it their own way.
Exactly.
It's not just about aviators. Well, Sam, it's a good question, so thank you. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We talked about Amelia Earhart. We talked about Ruth Nichols. There's a couple other women we should talk about, Keith. Ruth Elder, she's another famous person in this story.
So Ruth Elder emerges onto the scene in America right about this time, actually, just after Labor Day 1927. We're a few months removed from Charles Lindbergh successfully flying the ocean. He's come home. He's on his Goodwill tour. And Ruth Elder, who is 24 years old, on her second marriage, working answering the phones at a dentist's office in Florida, decides she wants to be the first woman to fly across the ocean. And, you know, she gets some money, she gets some funding, she also acquires a male co-pilot, and they blow onto Long Island just after Labor Day 1927, declaring that they're going to fly the ocean. And, you know, Ruth is a perfect example of everything we just talked about confidence and about bravado. You know, she was doubted from the moment she landed at Roosevelt Field in her bright orangish-red plane called the American Girl. the press couldn't believe that this young woman was going to fly across the ocean. And again, you know, in newspaper and radio reports, they doubt her. She'll say, well, yeah, I'm here to fly. And they'll say, no, but really, what are you really going to do?
You're trying to promote a movie or something.
Yeah. And you know,
get a modeling contract.
To me, like, the thing that she says that's so powerful, you know, amid all these questions and all these doubts, finally one reporter says, you know, okay, I understand you're going to go. Is it worth risking your life to do this? Because that's what you were doing if you were trying to fly across the ocean in 1927. You were really risking your life. And she just answered, yes, it is.
I wonder what lit the spark for these women. You know, you were just talking about Ruth Elder. She's answering phones in a dentist's office. Amelia Earhart, she's a social worker in the Chinese neighborhoods of Boston, trying to help Chinese immigrants. Another one of your characters in the book, I think, works for a coal company. I mean, they just, you know, what lights the spark for someone sitting answering phones in a dentist office and then all of a sudden says, I'm going to fly across the ocean?
Well, you know, each of them had an interest in aviation. You know, Ruth Elder was answering phones in a dentist's office. She had already flown and had, you know, tinkered with flying for at least a couple of years. Others had too. But I think you hit on something there, Laura, and I agree with it. You know, Ruth Elder is answering phones in a dentist's office in Florida. Amelia Earhart is working as a social worker in Boston. Louise Thaden is selling coal in Wichita. Florence Klingensmith is working at a dry cleaners in Fargo, North Dakota. And Ruth Nichols, you know, is stuck working at a bank in New York City.
Yeah, these are not the daughters of pilots,
no,
for the most part.
But each of them was unhappy with where they were in their life. This was not the life that they had imagined for themselves. And this is one of the things that I think unites them, one of the common traits that each of them has. You know, in a previous generation, these women may not have had options, and they may not have had the gumption to do what they wanted to do. But very emblematic of this time, each of these women, unhappy with where they are in their life, dissatisfied with their current situation, will change it. They will not accept the life that's being imposed on them. They will not sell coal. They will not answer phones in a dentist's office. That's not what they want to do. They want to fly, and they're going to make it happen.
And there's this aviation fever sweeping the country, as you said, so it sparks their imagination.
Absolutely.
So there's two other women we should mention, Keith. So we mentioned Ruth Elder, Ruth Nichols, Amelia Earhart. Two others in this book. Who are they?
So we just mentioned Louise Thaden, who got her start selling coal in Wichita in 1926. This was not the life she had imagined for herself. And so, you know, when she's out supposed to be selling coal, she finds herself drifting down to the airport in the grass east of town, watching the planes take off there. And it is there that she is spotted, essentially discovered, by a man named Walter Beach. This last name, Beach, might be familiar to some listeners, you know. It is the name that would ultimately become Beechcraft, a plane that is still with us today. Walter Beach is a young plane builder, and he's got his first company was not Beechcraft. It was called Travel Air, and it was based in Wichita, and he was opening a West Coast office. And Walter Beach was a very savvy businessman. In Louise Thaden, he saw an opportunity. She was tall. She had a distinctive look about her, wild dark hair, light gray blue eyes. And he realized that if he put Louise Thaden in his West Coast office, that the press would come calling soon enough. And so he gives her this opportunity to go work for him on the West Coast in Oakland. But to Louise's credit, you know, she gets this break, and then she earns everything. You know, within months, she's flying. Within months after that, she's setting records. And Louise Thaden was one of the rarest kind of aviators in these days. She was not just a woman who was flying planes and racing planes. She was a mother. So that's Louise Thaden.
That's a conflict for her.
It is.
It's tough.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think, you know, because of the sacrifices that Louise makes over the years for her children, you know, she has one in 1930 and another in 1933. Because of the sacrifices that she makes, you know, juggling her career and her personal ambitions with her love for her children and her responsibilities at home, we have forgotten her, you know? And to me, Louise is in some ways sort of the most modern kind of character in this book, because so many parents today, whether you're a father or a mother, can understand what that's like to juggle your personal ambitions with your responsibilities at home. You know, Louise was doing that in the early 1930s at a time when our culture, and indeed many husbands, still expected wives to stay home. And Louise wouldn't do that. She would do what we do today.
I want to ask you about Walter Beach and the other promoters of these women who saw their aviation as an opportunity to gain excitement about the industry, to encourage people to watch the races, maybe buy a plane themselves. But who's the last woman that is mentioned in the book?
The last woman is Florence Klingensmith, who I mentioned was working at a dry cleaner's in Fargo, North Dakota in 1927 when Charles Lindbergh flies the ocean. Florence is, born in rural Minnesota just across the river from Fargo. She's different from the start. She's daring and in some ways reckless. She rides a motorcycle as a teenage girl in Moorhead, Minnesota.
Oh, wow. That is different back then.
When that didn't happen. And when she would pay her fare on the streetcar in town there to go downtown, she wouldn't take a seat on board like everybody else. She would cling to the cow catcher up front, skimming just inches off the rails to the horror of the conductor. That was Florence Klingensmith. And, you know, by the early 1930s, in this ensemble cast of characters, Florence Klingensmith is really the most talented of the flyers, the most skilled. You know, Amelia Earhart made her name really flying long distance, making bold and daring flights over long distances. That was not Florence Klingensmith's game. She made her name flying at what was known as the free-for-all races. These were essentially NASCAR races in the sky, whipping your plane around pylons or small towers placed on the ground in a triangular course. You know, that is what Florence Klingensmith did. It was very difficult. It required the utmost of coordination and skill, and Florence was one of the best of them all at doing it.
Like a stunt pilot almost.
Not a stunt pilot, because they were racing. I mean, it was a flat out race around these courses with other planes in the sky right with you. So you're flying 200 miles an hour or more, 75 feet off the ground or less, in a crowd of other planes whipping around pylons. It was extremely dangerous.
Don't you wish? Did you watch newsreels of this? Did they take newsreels of those? Because that sounds amazing to watch.
They did. There's some amazing footage of it, and of course, in the footage of the races, there's also, footage of crashes as well.
Well, coming up, Keith, I want to ask you a little bit more about these showmen who decided that, yes, investing in these women was a good idea. It would bring them money and fame, as well as the women. So we'll talk about that. And then we should talk about Amelia Earhart's story. We've got some clips of Ms. Earhart herself talking about what aviation meant to her. So all that's coming up after a short break. And we'll keep taking your emails, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the New Hampshire News Roundup. And with the state primaries less than a week away, there'll be a lot to cover. So be sure to join us for that tomorrow morning live at 9. This hour, the author of a new book called Fly Girls is here. It's a book about the history of women in aviation, five women in particular. Let's get your questions and comments in. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Again, exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or call 1-800-892-6477. And Keith, here's an email from Mike in New London who says, your book does not appear to include Pancho Barnes, certainly the most flamboyant female aviator of the era, who held the speed record for a short time. I'd like to know why she didn't make your book. And Mike, thank you for the email.
So just to be totally clear to you, Mike, and to all the listeners, this isn't an encyclopedic history of women in aviation in the 1920s and 30s, where each woman gets her own chapter and that sort of thing. If you were to write that kind of book, you would need 40 chapters. This is one specific story about a handful of women who were rivals but also friends. Who were right there with each other. And when they would crash, as they all would, they would be at each other's bedside to console them. So that's what this story is about. It's really a story of an ensemble cast. Pancho Barnes is in the book. She is part of the first women's air race in 1929, which was a big breakthrough for these women. And Pancho Barnes briefly leads that air race. And so she and many others are part of this story. But, one of the hardest decisions any writer has to make is who to include and how.
Right.
And when you're telling a specific narrative, one narrative thread, you need to really boil down who are the key characters. And so there were a lot of difficult choices to make here. But because of specifically of the friendship and the rivalry that Ruth Nichols, Amelia Earhart, and Louise Thaden had, and because of the daring flights that Ruth Elder and Florence Klingensmith would make during this time, they really formed the heart and soul of this book. Pancho Barnes was an incredible aviator, and other books have been written about her.
Well, and you describe their relationship as rivals in the air and friends on the ground.
That's right.
Which is remarkable, really, because they did compete fiercely in the air.
They did. I mean, to their credit, they were friends, and they never let any kind of rivalry in the sky get in the way on the ground. They knew they needed to stick together on the ground in order to win equality, to win the right to race, to keep racing. But absolutely, just like the men, they wanted to win. They wanted to win the races. They wanted to be the first to cross the ocean. They were in it because they loved it. But as anybody who does anything knows, when you're passionate about something, you want to be the best you can be. And that's what these women wanted to be.
Let's talk a little bit about the air race promoters, Keith. You described them as showmen, big personalities, big plans, big hopes to make a lot of money during a Great Depression, which was definitely a challenge. Who were these guys? What were they like?
Well, you mentioned the word showman, and a lot of them did have a Barnum and Bailey aspect to them, most notably Cliff Henderson, the promoter and director of the air races, who gets his break forming the first modern air races in 1928 in that bean and barley field south of Los Angeles that would one day become LAX. Cliff Henderson was bombastic. He was grandiose. Every race he held, he would declare would be the greatest races ever. He knew he had a way with the press. And in a lot of ways, he had the press in his back pocket. When mishaps would occur in the races and people would die, very rarely did the press question Cliff Henderson or the other race organizers. It was never their fault that these races had gone sideways or that someone had died. And then, of course, the double standard would be when one of these women would crash, the press would criticize her but not criticize the races themselves.
Well, and at one point in the book, there's a woman who crashes, and it's blamed not on her faulty aircraft, which I believe was created by a guy from New Hampshire, I think. Granny.
That's right. Yeah. Sanford Granville.
So she crashes, and it's blamed on the fact that she might have been having her period. When somebody else crashes, a guy pilot in the same kind of plane, it's just, oh, gee, that's too bad. What a tragedy.
I mean, that's correct. And that to me was one of the most infuriating things that I discovered during this research. You know, you're talking about Florence Klingensmith. And the plane she was flying that day was a GB. It was built by Zanford Granville, a New Hampshire native, who built them in Springfield, Massachusetts, for a handful of years in the late 1920s, early 1930s. GBs were one of the fastest planes of this time, but they were extremely unreliable and very dangerous. Many men had died flying a GB. And you know, Florence is flying that plane this day in Chicago. And the crowd on the ground in this free-for-all race around pylons sees the wing disintegrate. They see the wing break apart in the air. Florence knows it is broken apart and does exactly as she's supposed to do. She peels off course away from the crowd, ultimately crashes, ultimately dies. You know, this is a pretty simple case of mechanical failure. But the race organizers, the aviation officials, and ultimately the coroner in Chicago, instead blame it on the fact that Florence Klingensmith was menstruating at the time. And you know, as shocking as that sounds to us now, that this would even be suggested, in the 1930s, the U.S. Department of Commerce, which was the regulating agency of aviation, wrote into its rules that it was unadvisable for a woman to operate an airplane within 3 days of her period. That was written in U.S. government rules. And, you know, to me, stumbling upon that, you know, and seeing how Florence was treated in the press was one of the most shocking and infuriating things.
And there's somebody a little bit later, right? A guy who dies. Same thing, same problem with this aircraft. And again, it's just said, oh, it's so sad that this happened.
One year later, a prominent male aviator will die in a very similar fashion. His plane wing will disintegrate in mid-air during a flight.
Same thing.
He will go down. He will die. And this is really a turning point because 1934 now, even the press realizes, wow, this is a double standard that we can't endure. And it's the first time when the press begins to point out, Doug Davis and Florence Klingensmith have died in exactly the same manner, and you're treating them in different ways, and that's probably wrong.
I want to talk a little bit more before we close out, Keith, about Amelia Earhart. I did not know until I read this book that she really used her flying fame to promote the broader cause of rights for women. How did she do that?
So to Amelia Earhart's enduring credit, you know, she used her platform for good at almost every turn. You know, she was so famous and so well known in the late 1920s, early 1930s. She could have done anything. She could have become an actress. She could have just given speeches around the country. Instead, she really does advocate for women and young girls. She makes what were at the time some bold and radical statements. She believes women should be drafted to fight. She believes that if women were drafted to fight in war, it would give politicians pause about going to war. She says in many of her speeches that men should know the drudgery of housework and women should know the drudgery of a workaday life. You know, she is advocating at every turn for equality. And, you know, she will really make an impact on a lot of young girls. And not just through the newspapers or the people who saw her speak or saw her fly. She will, you know, near the end of her life, get hired to teach at Purdue University. And you know, a school that was really dedicated to and still is dedicated to STEM work, STEM research, science, engineering. It had a very small roster of female students at the time. The dean of Purdue, the president of Purdue, hires her, gives her a position, and gives her a room in the all-women's dormitory there where she really does change women's lives.
Well, she was big on, as you said, freeing women from household drudgery. She saw that as a way to bring economic independence for women. And she was a big fan of science in that role. I want to play a little bit from one of the many, many, many speeches that Amelia Earhart gave. This is called A Woman's Place in Science. This is from a radio broadcast in 1935. And here she makes the point, as you said, Keith, that she made over and over that science and invention had led to greatly better lives for women.
Science has released them from much of the age-old drudgery connected with the process of living. Candle dipping, weaving, and crude methods of manufacturing necessities are things of the past for an increasing majority. Today, light, heat, and power may be obtained by pushing buttons, and cunningly manufactured and appealing products of all the world are available at the housewife's door.
And as you said, Keith, she had some pretty radical ideas for the time. You know, women should be drafted, men should do housework. How were those ideas received in the general public?
Well, you can imagine they were received differently by different audiences.
Sure, because she was such a star, so people listened to what she had to say.
She was a star, and she was always on the speaking circuit. George Putnam, her husband, made sure to keep her out there, even at times when Amelia herself didn't really want to be out there. You know, Louise Thadon, you know, wrote later that, you know, she would cross paths with Amelia on the speaking circuit and spend nights with her sometimes in hotels and find Amelia to be gray with fatigue. You know, she was moving from town to town, giving speeches, often the same speeches. But, you know, she would make these statements, these radical statements about, you know, women, you know, working or women being drafted, whether she was speaking to conservative Kansas housewives or liberal Yale University students. She did not care what people thought about what she was saying. She truly believed it, and she advocated for it.
I've got an email here from Lauren who says, I love this program and today's topic. Flying has been part of my family since my grandfather flew in the Air Force. He unfortunately died when my mom was 9, but many years later, my mother took flight lessons when she was in her 40s. She soloed, but didn't end up getting her license because her husband at the time said it was too dangerous. I myself, Lauren says, have 10 hours under my belt as a helicopter pilot. I currently work in the aviation industry and feel very fortunate to be able to go up whenever I want. Lauren says, thank you. She looks forward to reading the book. Thank you, Lauren, for the email. And it does get us to the present day, Keith. You know, this history is from almost 100 years ago. How common is it today to have a female pilot when you, you know, get on the airline to fly to Chicago?
Well, unfortunately, the numbers are still quite low. In this country, 7% of all licensed pilots are women. And when you go to airlines, commercial airlines, that number drops even more. And, you know, it was shocking to me to see how we got there. You know, the first female commercial airline pilot is hired in 1934. Her name is Helen Ritchie. She's hired by Central Airlines, and it does not go well. Within months, Helen Ritchie is forced out because the all-male pilots union will not accept her. And the government places all kinds of restrictions on when Ritchie can or cannot fly in this weather or that weather with this many passengers, effectively grounding her.
Wow.
So she's out. And as a journalist, my question when I stumbled upon that was, well, when was the next woman hired? And it was 1973. 39 years later.
Seriously, within like 40 years, there were no female pilots.
Correct.
From that first pilot.
Commercial airline pilots. 1973, Frontier hires a woman. They're still a very small airline at the time. And American Airlines hires a woman. And, you know, the pilot that American hires is 26 years old. She's from Florida. She's the daughter of a pilot. She tells the press, so a woman flies no differently than a man. The same kind of comments that Amelia Earhart and others would make in the 1920s and 30s. But to me, one of the stunning things was to see still in 1973 how this pilot was treated. You know, most shockingly, the Los Angeles Times, one of our country's most prestigious newspapers, ran a feature about her that summer under the headline that said, airline pilot to fly by seat of her panties.
Oh.
1973. And, you know, it's a disgusting headline. And it's really horrifying that they did that. And you know who remembers that headline is the pilot herself. Her name is Bonnie Taberzi Caputo. She's retired now. She lives in New York. She would fly for American Airlines for almost 25 years.
What do you think is behind those low numbers, Keith? Is it that, you know, is it discrimination? Is it that women are less exposed because they tend not to serve in the Air Force? Is it, you know, some people might say, well, maybe women don't want to fly. Clearly, Fly Girls puts that to rest. But why do you suppose that's the case?
Well, I want to be very clear. Today, airlines are making every effort to hire women, to hire any experienced pilot. The airlines in this country are facing a serious pilot shortage in the
years
to come.
Right, the aging of the workforce, absolutely.
So women are in demand. And in the military, where there are aircraft, in the Army, in the Navy, in the Air Force, the number of female pilots has really exploded in the last 20 years, at times doubling. So things have changed. Things are changing. But, you know, when you go back, as I did in this book, and you look at the early years, you see how entrenched the discrimination was. And, you know, when you go between 1934 and 1973 without hiring a female pilot, I think that says volumes about how far the industry, you know, struggled to come in those years. And while they're making gains now, there's just a lot of catch-up that needs to happen.
Well, and there was a headline last week about Alaska Air having the first flight with two African-American female pilots. So there was some attention to that.
Absolutely. I mean, and you know, there's a lot of data now, a lot of real reliable data that shows that female pilots are just as good as a man, just as safe. This data goes back into the 1970s, examining crashes, examining rates of crashes. And female pilots, just objectively, are just as safe as a man.
Well, Keith O'Brien, I want to close out a hair early with you today because we have a great song that was written in 1927 about Ruth Elder, one of the pilots profiled in your book called Flaming Ruth. So, Keith, thank you so much for being here. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you for having me.
That's Keith O'Brien. The book is called Fly Girls. And as I said, we're going to close out with a song written about Ruth Elder, Flaming Ruth, December 1927.
When up in the sky the American eagle taught you to fly, Flaming Ruth, we're proud in telling the world that you are an American girl. Among the nation's heroes there's one we all admire. She dared the roaring ocean soar. It was her one desire. She didn't mind the danger. She had no thought of fear. And now
the views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.